Hello and welcome to a Brave Space podcast with Dr. Meeks. I'm your host, Chelsea Glasgow, and today Dr. Meeks sends you peace, love, and even a present because in this episode, you will hear special clips from our annual Bishop Frank Kellogg Allen and Elizabeth Ansley Allen lecture. Our guest speaker and dear friend of the center, the Reverend Philip A. Jackson, came all the way from Trinity Wall Street to share his insightful thoughts and questions for the future, for our churches, for our communities, and for our children. So, without any further ado, let's take a listen.
I'm going to share with you four things today that are, well, three, maybe four, depending on how good of an audience you are. The fourth one, I may just, like, run. A couple years ago, I was reading an essay. You ever, anybody heard of a man named Teju Coles? He's a writer of... A young black writer up in New York, and he wrote a series of essays called Known and Strange Things. And I just want to read you a little piece, and you'll see where I'm going. He says, this is from his essay in that collection called Black Body. He says, "And yet I, born in the United States more than a half a century after Baldwin, continue to understand, because I have experienced in my own body the undimmed fury he felt about racism. In his writing, there is a hunger for life, for all of it, and a strong wish to not be accounted nothing when he knows himself to be so much. And this so much is neither a matter of ego about his writing, nor an anxiety about his fame in New York or in Paris. It is about the incontestable fundamentals of a person: pleasure, sorrow, love, humor, and grief. And here's the part I love: and the complexity of the interior landscape that sustains those feelings." Baldwin was astonished that anyone, anywhere, should question those fundamentals, thereby burdening him with the supreme waste of time that is racism, let alone so many people in so many places. The supreme waste of time that is racism. I don't know, do you ever think about what a waste of our time it is to have to spend worrying about racism? The human experiment is rich and complex and difficult enough as it is to live with, what does he say, grief, sadness, pleasure, all those things we live with day to day, just as human beings, are enough in and of themselves to think about, that when we then have to add on racism to that, you could understand, I certainly can understand, Baldwin's frustration at having to take that one on too. It seems a little gratuitous. It seems like an add-on that is not particularly necessary. It seems like life gives us enough to think about, to feel, to appreciate, and to love without having to add that one on too. And that evening, as I sat around Baldwin with these professors and others, it was clear that this was a man for whom dealing with racism was a waste of his time. He was too smart for it. He had to deal with it, but he was too smart for it, and it wasted his time. all of that is prelude to what's been on my mind. What's been on my mind is simply this. This is number one. Has anyone been following the results of the federal reading and math test scores for fourth and eighth graders in the United States? This year, they came out about a month ago. Actually, they came out earlier in the spring, but they didn't release them until about a month ago. This year, the fourth and eighth graders, which is a test they give every year to fourth and eighth graders, a federal test, were the lowest they've been in almost three decades. Now, some of that, much of that is pandemic, okay? Much of that is pandemic. Some of it, though, especially for black kids, okay, they were already behind pre-pandemic. We all know this, right? We all know this, right? Now, here's the part you'll love. Do you know that the private prison industry uses the fourth and eighth grade reading and math scores to project their growth? Did you know that? Because that's deeply cynical and scary. And I think it's true. I think it's true. Think about that. Fourth and eighth graders are being said to have a trajectory that's taking them to a growth model for prisons, right? So there are a couple things that have been on my mind in this regard. One is mental health among our kids post-pandemic, number one. And Trinity will tell you, Trinity, I don't know if anybody knows Trinity, but Trinity is like a giant aircraft carrier. It's 322 years old, and it has its own imperatives. And Trinity moves like this. And in order to get it to move direction, you kind of have to like hope that it'll just go like this. It's very slow. Trinity does its thing. And so as the pandemic was, and I'm no prophet, I'm no genius about this stuff, but it seemed to me pretty clear that what we were doing with our kids during the pandemic was going to be a disaster, was going to be an absolute disaster. You've heard the stories, right? Kids were kind of like zoomed out. Heck, I was zoomed out, right? People, they weren't going online. They were turning their screens off. New York City alone lost 100,000 kids. Don't know where they went in the public school system. Don't know, no record. Don't know where they went. Gone, okay? It's bad. And then we started hearing how, and you probably heard the same thing down here, how kids were kind of more combative. They didn't know how to make friends. They didn't know how to deal with adults. They weren't dealing well. They weren't growing up well, right? And if it's happening at name the blue ribbon private school in Atlanta, whatever that one is, okay, then it's happening at, and I'm just gonna guess, there's a Martin Luther King High School here, right? Just guess what's happening there, okay? And so mental health was number one for me. And then as a subset of that, I started really getting interested in just the way our kids are being asked to bear things that are beyond just what it means, and this is to tie it back to the Baldwin thing, just beyond, not just beyond, but things that are beyond just being a kid. Just being a kid is enough. You remember being a kid? Being a kid is hard. I mean, we like I don't know, Hollywoodized it or something. It was hard. You got to figure all that stuff out. You got your buddies and friends, and you're all trying to figure it out. It's hard work. I don't want to go through that. That's why I don't watch movies about adolescence. I don't want to go through that again. It was horrible. It amazes me there's a whole cottage industry about films about adolescence. Who cares about that? Go away. But think about what we're asking our kids to bear. We're asking our kids to bear above and beyond just being kids. And then you take black and brown kids and you say, oh, you got a couple things we need you to handle. You got to deal with racism. And you got to deal with this pandemic thing, too. Good luck. Good luck with that. By the way, everything I'm going to say to you, I have no answer for. She just asked me to say what was on my mind. That's been on my mind. That's been on my mind. That's number one. Number two, anybody ever read or heard of Wendell Berry? Anybody read any Wendell Berry? Yeah, good. If you haven't read Wendell Berry, you should read some Wendell Berry. But his latest book is called The Need to Be Whole. I'm going to read you a little bit from this book. It just came out a couple months ago, and I'm making my way through it. I think you'll get the gist of why this interests you. But this is on my mind. This too is on my mind. Ready? He says, the news has obliged us to imagine a public demonstration, in fact, a public allegory, in which the self-denominated side of love has confronted the side of hate, believing that a victory of love over hate will secure equality and justice to people who have been oppressed because of their race. I recommend second thoughts about the possibility of a side of love, but current political rhetoric tends towards such an absolute division. The side of hate is composed of avowed racists. Avowed racists have espoused an absolute, unaccepting prejudice against a kind of people, and so they may be called the side of hate, rightly enough. That haters hate is morally as straightforward and uncomplicated as it can be. But they themselves are perceived by the side of love as a kind of people. And the side of love, as perceived by the side of hate, is a kind of people also, another kind. And so we have a confrontation of two opposite kinds of people, lovers and haters. Each side is absolute in its identity as it can make itself, and they do not know each other. They cannot imagine each other. For the haters, the situation is wonderfully simple and entirely acceptable. They don't even need a notion of consequence. They are there to oppose, that is all. The lovers, on the contrary, have everything at stake, and the situation is clouded by moral danger. Because the confrontation is between two categories of people who do not know each other, it will be easy for the side of love first to understand love merely as opposite and opposed to hate, and then to generalize this opposition as an allegorical battle of love versus hate, exchanging slogan for slogan, gesture for gesture, shout for shout. Then, if nature and the rule of battle go unchecked, the side of love begins to hate the side of hate, and then the lovers are defeated, for they have defeated themselves. They have fallen into the sort of trap that Mr. Jefferson set for, among others, himself. If you say all are created equal, then adding, except for some, the exception overturns the rule, and a great deal else along with it. Just so, love that hates has canceled itself. It cannot survive its hatred of hate any more than one can survive minus one. It is no more. Chaos and old night have come again. With us, love has been reduced mostly to a popular word, easy to use to intensify a frivolous appreciation. Oh, I love it, we say, when told of something really cute. Or it can be used as a handy weapon against the haters of whom we disapprove. Too bad. But love comes into our civilization, the Gospels being the best source known to me, as a way of being in the world. It is a force extraordinarily demanding and humbling, dangerous too, for those who attempt to take it seriously. As a force and a way of being, love is never satisfied with partiality. It is compelled by its own nature and logic to be always trying to make itself whole. This is why the Sermon on the Mount tells us to love our enemies. That is an unconditional statement. It does not tell us to fight our enemies in order to improve them or convert them by our love. In practice, this commandment seems to cancel or delete enemy as a category of thought. What I most valued, at least what moved me most, in reading the statements of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in the mid-1960s, was the realization that Martin Luther King Jr. was not thinking of white people as, quote, the enemy, even though he and his people had to confront the enmity of many white people. It was clear to me that he saw the freedom he sought for black people as a freedom needed also by white people, and I agreed. No freedom could belong securely to any part of the people that did not securely belong to all of them. Dr. King's movement in this way escaped the specialization that usually afflicts movements. He said, "Justice is love correcting that which revolts against love." This is a version of love uncommonly serious. Deliberately, a religious, a Christian version, readily allied to Jefferson's inspired glimpse of human rights as a divine endowment, as opposed to a gift from the state. This love is not much subject to control or limitation by humans. It was love's impulse, its self-moving toward wholeness, that moved King from concern for black people to concern for poor people, to concern at last for all people, their land and culture. Or so I have understood him. And here I am remembering also Will Campbell, the improved Southern Baptist preacher, a white man who had first helped the black people in their civil rights movement, believing that they were the least of Christ's brethren. But then realizing that they might not, after all, be the least, or if the least, not the only ones, Brother Campbell felt that his own work was incomplete. He then troubled to get to know members of the Ku Klux Klan, whom he had considered his enemies. He offered them, instead of correction and retribution, kindness and help. And so he admitted them also into his consciousness and care. He was an embarrassment and a troublemaker. No doubt an actual follower of Jesus. Do I have to comment on that? That's been on my mind too. That's been on my mind too. Wow. That's hard work. What if that's the gospel? And by what if I mean it is. What does that make you think? We can talk about that in a minute, but how does that make you think? What does it make you feel? I don't know about you, but that stirred up in me some self-correction, some self-examination, and some self-care. What does it mean to love? What does it mean to describe others as haters? What does it mean to look inside of ourselves and see where we are on things? What if love that hates is like 1 minus 1 nothing. It ain't love, because love can't help but love. Love cannot exist in the same space as hate. I'll stop there before I get in trouble. But I've been thinking about that too. Here's the third thing I'm thinking about. So I'm getting old. I told you I turned 60 in a couple months. And I got to tell you, this getting out of bed in the morning thing, it's getting harder and harder. It's like creaky, achy, and then just, man, it's like, where did that come from? And so I'm like, so it's been, I've been thinking about like, what is, I'm like, where are we going from here? I think I kind of know where we're going from here. I've been thinking about getting old. And I've been thinking then, you know, it's caused me to sort of reflect on my life. This is going to either appall you or amaze you. I was baptized at the age of 27. I came to Christ at the age of 27 at the parish of St. Clements in Honolulu, Hawaii. After a mystical experience that I had, unasked for, unbidden, unsought, undesired, by a Lord who reached out to me and introduced himself to me one day. And I have been a priest now I'm in my 29th year. I was a lawyer before. And I put all that down. People say to me, oh, it must have been so hard and difficult. And I usually now I go, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. But really my thought bubble is, that was the best thing that ever happened to me in eternity. Okay. And so I've been thinking about that call that my Lord put on me 30 years ago. And now I'm at Trinity Wall Street, right? And people have many different views of what Trinity is. It's none of those, by the way. It's a church. But I wanted to read, anybody ever heard of a guy named Emmanuel Carrère, a French novelist? He wrote a book called The Kingdom, which is kind of an autobiographical, exegetical look at sort of his faith journey coupled with an extended exegesis on the Pauline epistles and the Gospels. You gotta read it to believe it, but it works. It's brilliant. And at the end, I just want to read to you the final paragraph of the novel. Hopefully this will make some sense. He says, I wrote this book that I'm now bringing to a close in good faith. But what it attempts to deal with is so much larger than I am that this good faith, I know, is paltry in comparison. I wrote it encumbered with everything that makes me what I am. Intelligent, rich, a man at the top. So many obstacles to entering the kingdom. Nevertheless, I tried. And what I wonder as I leave it is if it betrays the young man I was and the Lord he believed in, or if in its way it remains faithful to them. I don't know. I've been thinking about that because I'm the type of Christian that believes in some form or another I'm going to have to sort of make an accounting. I'm going to have to make an accounting of my life. I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know what that's going to entail, but somehow I think my Lord already has the account of my life in front of him. And I just hope, in some way, as I get older and approach death, I just hope that I've been faithful to what he first gave me. I hope that I've treasured it, and I've hoped that I've loved it, and I've hoped that I've been faithful to it. Do you ever think that? Do you ever wonder, have I been faithful to the gift, to the treasure that I've been given? I hope I have been. I know when I get up there in front of him, and it's not going to be, you know, a courtroom, it's just going to be him saying, I know everything about you. And that if I start arguing, I've lost. Right? As soon as I say, yeah, but, it's done. I just have to say, I hope so. I hope so. I hope I've been faithful to what you've asked me to do. That's been on my mind too, as I approach my 60th birthday. I got no answer for that one, believe me, but it's been on my mind.
Would you like to hear the enriching Q&A portion of this program? Visit us on YouTube by searching Center for Racial Healing. We hope you enjoyed this podcast special and look forward to you joining us in our next Brave Space. If you're ready for more insights on upcoming programs and valuable resources for you and your community, visit centerforracialhealing.org. Stay connected with us on social media, on all platforms at Center for Racial Healing. And it's until next time, always remember to tell the truth. Bye-bye.